name is Dave. I'm one of the pastors here at Compass Point, and it is a joy to have you. Before we jump in, why don't you, just for the people who are listening online, why don't you just introduce yourselves really quickly?
Anu George Kanjanathopoul, CEO with International Justice Mission Canada, the world's largest anti-human trafficking organization.
Amazing.
Lawyer by training, everything else by accident.
Love that.
And mom of two twin daughters.
Absolutely.
I am Allison Alley. I'm the president and CEO of Compassion Canada, which is a global church equipping holistic child development organization. I am also a mom of two daughters, a little bit older than Anu, so I have much wisdom to impart, I'm sure.
And they listen.
Amazing. Well, let's dive right in. Both of you, had a brief amount of time this morning to share about the work that you get to be a part of, about work that your organizations do. And I'm wondering if you each had maybe one more story that you could share with us, maybe something you've personally experienced on the field or something that really highlighted the importance and the depth of the work that you get to be a part of.
I can go sure. First. My friend Ruby, you can actually hear more about her story on a 6-part podcast called Finding Ruby. She was a young girl when she was baited and trapped into online sexual exploitation years ago. And she was offered a job at a time when she lost both her parents and her siblings. She was one of the 10 kids. Her siblings were not treating her fairly, and she was physically abused. And she was like looking for an outlet, a way of getting out of that situation. So this job that came over Facebook helped. And she was offered money and a place to stay. She went in to discover that it was actually a cyber sex trafficking den. Mm. She had no way that she could escape. And she shares about the night that she prayed and the morning that IJM came, along with the police officials extracting her and several other girls from that situation. And I'm not going to get into the details of how she was exploited in that space. Well, you can very well imagine what it would have been for Ruby. But I want to spend some time talking about who she is today.
Yeah.
An incredibly fun-loving human being. Both of us share notes on Korean dramas and recipes and talk about things which are mundane but also real in a way that she could not have experienced otherwise as a victim of online sexual exploitation. Ruby, to me, is an epitome of hope, of faith, and also joy. I did earlier talk about, you know, the nights that keeps me, that I stay awake thinking about the hard things in the world. But Ruby, true to her name, is actually a gem that reminds me that this work is worth staying up in the night and worrying about, and also showing up in the morning joyfully and faithfully. Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing.
You know, maybe what I would share, I just got back from Mexico with a bunch of our staff. It was a training trip for those who are hired post-COVID and haven't been able to travel yet. And one of the things that we often talk about as an organization is that the heroes of our ministry are certainly not us. Are not in isolation, our supporters and donors and partners, though that matters, all of our roles matter, but is actually our frontline leaders and staff and tutors, the people who are planted in their communities and are sacrificially, and this is the point, giving of their life to serve their neighbors in need day in and day out. And we're a part of rallying around them so they can do that important work. So when I was in Mexico, three out of the four frontline church partners that we visited had a senior pastor that passed away from COVID-19.
Wow.
And when you sat with one of them, the widow has now stepped into the senior pastor role of this church to carry out the legacy of loving and serving their neighbors in need that her husband started. And she just said, I couldn't keep my husband away from being on the front line and ensuring that there was not just food, though that was needed, and help, though that was needed, but he was physically showing up to be an expression of hope in families that were just in desperate circumstances, and it cost him his life. Mm-hmm. And so we just have so many of those stories. You have so many of those stories at IJM, more so than Compassion, but to recognize that We don't just stand on the shoulder of giants as Jesus followers, though that's been a reflection point for me in this season, but we're standing shoulder to shoulder Amen. With amazing people who love Jesus every day in the trenches.
True.
So tying kind of into that, obviously the work you both are a part of has been going on for a long time, and there's so much good in it. But what about this cultural moment right now is uniquely challenging? So we've come through COVID-19, as you said, and we heard some stats this morning. But what, like, if you were to pick one challenge that you are facing as a leader of an organization trying to do this good work, what would that be today?
So I'm looking at my staff and laughing because sometimes if you ask me one thing, it's a multifaceted one thing always. And in actuality, before you said what is the one thing, Dave, I was thinking about the fact that it's everything.
Yeah.
It is living in this cultural moment. This geopolitical reality is unbelievably complex. When we talk about economic realities, power shifts, which have geopolitical implications for countries like Canada. We talk about environmental instability and just the sheer amount of natural disasters that are happening. We talk about the role of technology in advancing new opportunities for things like advocacy and awareness, but also wreaking havoc in the life of the most vulnerable, which Anu touched on earlier. Mm-hmm. You think about immigration trends and complication around that, the changing church, the fragmented church. And for whatever reason, this is the moment that God has not just called Anu and I and our organizations to live and lead through, but every single one of us to be the hands and feet and voice of Jesus as the cultural currents are swirling around us. So that's heavy, and it's heavy because our focus as an organization practically right now is to advance whole life outcomes with more children and youth more quickly. So we want to ensure that we're attaining holistic outcomes by moving into areas of greater need and enhancing our programmatic work, maybe a conversation for another time, but to reach them more quickly while reaching more and scaling the organization. So that God-given vision and mandate in the context we're navigating is extremely complex and requires much wisdom, discernment, prayer, and partnership, right? Okay. To be deeply seated in really cross-sector partnerships, but certainly sector partnerships in every country that we work in.
Okay.
So that wasn't one thing
at
all.
Yeah, your one thing is everything. I get that.
That's okay. That's what keeps me up. What about you, Anu?
Yeah, I mean, Allison could not have summed this better. It is all of those things, but you know, specifically if we were to break down, when the pandemic hit, 140% violence increased. Hmm. Like the children that were available for cyber sexual exploitation increased by 140%. So just in 2022, you're looking at 1 million children who are exploited by this entire multi-billion dollar industry. When the war came about, our teams had to rush to the borders to make sure, one of the wars, make sure that they were able to get to Romania, the Romanian borders, before the perpetrators could, because trafficking immediately increases. Right. The minute there is a crisis, whether it's an earthquake, whether it is a man-created disaster, whatever it is, the most vulnerable are the most oppressed, those who are in poverty, those who are women, those who are children. And IGM's responsibility has been to respond to these crises. And this wouldn't be news to you, but the last few years have not been fun for the world. I mean, things have been changing at a pace that it's not welcome, whether it is the pandemic or everything else that is happening because of the way countries engage with each other. So IGM has been trying to respond, and it is not easy because we have a roadmap that's clearly charted out to protect 500 million people by 2030. And like we know, like all things don't always fall in plan. Suddenly the pandemic hit. So how do we readjust things? How do we ensure that we are stepping in to serve those who need us more in that specific space than now? And then the obvious concern that Allison and I chatted about even last week, resources. This is a multi-billion dollar industry. Someone's poverty is somebody's income. So how do you respond to that when there is such limited resource to tackle that problem? And we are trying to find ways to navigate that, and the challenge increases if we think that we can do this alone. Mm-hmm. And that is why I keep coming back to giant, larger-than-life problem, but glad we can do this in partnership. So those are things that we are trying to work through.
Yeah. Oh, so many huge challenges that
I
you
only
guys
gave you seven.
Face. Yeah, that's fine. That's great. So I want to shift a little bit. We've been talking kind of big picture about the work you get to be a part of, and I think that's so important. But you as leaders have to wear a lot and carry a lot of that, right? You understand, even trying to answer a question about challenges, like there are so many. How do you in your life practice keeping the good things that God is doing central? So, and the reason I'm asking this, I want to know. Here at our church, we talk a lot about embracing a rule of life. So sets of rhythms and practices that open us up to the good work of God. You know, obvious things like reading our Bibles and praying, but also practicing Sabbath. Some of these things that are intentional and countercultural, and I know for me and for many others, have been life-giving in seasons where it can feel overwhelming. So I'm curious, for both of you, what do you do that helps you keep the good work that God is doing front and center?
It helps having the organization that is centered in Christ. You know, it helps showing up at a workplace where this half an hour stillness is mandatory. You are forced. It's part of our daily work day. You know, half an hour we spend time in stillness, and half an hour we come together in corporate prayer every single day. And it also helps that we have been mandated and reminded by the CEO of the organization that this is God's burden to bear.
Right.
You know, it is his burden to bear, and it is our work to do. Mm-hmm. And being able to be part of a community that is continuously working towards being spiritually transformed people so that we can take this outside to the world has been really helpful. And because I get asked this question oftentimes, it gives me the opportunity to keep mulling over, why is it that I'm hope-filled? Mm-hmm. Yes, it is dark. Yes, it is challenging. Yes, it sometimes feels like your soul is getting sucked out of yourself. But it is also having the ability to remember how God has shown up.
Right.
Time and again and again and again. Like personally for me as a survivor of violence, being able to know, okay, in 2009, this was not a reality. I was not able to stand up. I was not able to walk. I was not able to speak. Come 2023, you know, we've been able to rescue tens of thousands of people, protected millions of people. And here I am in Canada, able to lead a movement of Canadians to say yes to justice and saying, yes, this problem can end. Yes, we can protect 500 million people. So I think memory is a good thing. Mm-hmm. You know, whether you're looking through the scriptures or whether you're looking through your own life or whether you're looking at how the organization has grown from this man working out of the basement to a few thousand people, you know, committed to showing up with partnerships around the world to end injustice. So I think memory is good. Reminding yourself that it's not your burden to bear is good. And having these spiritual practices to keep you grounded is good. That's how it works for me.
Yeah.
That's how it works for most of us.
Amazing.
What about you, Allison?
Oh, I love that. You know, this is a top of mind conversation that we engage in a lot at Compassion. And it stems from the question and the conviction, how do we do the work of God without compromising the work of God in us? And we know that for anyone in ministry in general, certainly when it's life or death urgency of the mission work that you do, it's so easy to burn out doing God's work and really compromise the rootedness that he calls us to. Mm-hmm. And so I love that you talked about a personal rule of life, because when I started at Fuller Theological Seminary many moons ago now, many moons would be quantified as maybe 9 years, I'm not sure, but the first book that I read, not many moons at all for some of you, was Ken Shigematsu, if you know him.
Yep.
God in My Everything. He's the pastor of 10th Avenue Church in Vancouver. And he talks about a personal rule of life or rhythm rhythms of life and how important it is that we are rooted in the Lord, that we have restorative practices, that we relate in healthy, well-engaged ways with people around us. And of course, from there, we reach out missionally, locally, and globally. And so that's a practice that I put in place actually about 9 years ago. And we've had Ken come and spend time with our staff in the context of a spiritual retreat. So that concept of having the rhythms of life that really create and sustain mm-hmm. the life that God has called us to lead. And practically, I think the challenge is to really choose yeah. to lead from the depth of our beingness in Him, from our rootedness in Him, from just sitting and soaking in His presence to then, you know, joining Him in your doing from there. I think it's a lifelong journey of evolving and figuring out how to do that well, but those practices in the context of community helps.
Mm, yeah, so good.
Wonderful.
So one of the things I love about this conversation right now is I get to have this conversation with both of you, and you are both articulate and passionate and women. And I think that's actually like, that's different than maybe what a lot of the world is used to, and it's different than maybe even what a lot of organizations are used to. How has that, in your role as chief leaders in your organizations, how has that been? How has that give you unique opportunities or unique challenges, and how have you been responding to that? Like, are there things that being a woman allows you to do or inspire hope in new ways, or is it uniquely challenging and you get up each day knowing that there's a grind? Easy question.
We've
right?
never had this conversation.
Definitely yeah. not. Yeah. Definitely not. Well, I think being a woman makes you a much better leader. And I'm sure it's going to bring a lot of controversy in the room, but I'm sure there is research which I haven't read. I'm sure there are people I haven't met who agrees with me right now. But I think there is this unique ability that, and I'm not speaking for myself here, I'm going to, you know, drag Allison into this, because I've seen how she rolls, I've seen how she leads, and I'm like, yeah, I mean, that makes sense. And I think you're able to do that because there is that channel of empathy which turns on, and that sense of urgency that comes on because you're a mother, because you are a woman, and you have that ability to have that space that is beyond what is drawn for regular human beings. I'm not calling out men here, but regular human beings to take in. Mm-hmm. And I think for me personally, I've always been driven by my sense of urgency. One, it came as a survivor of violence first, and I thought, well, this is how much Anu's capacities are capped at. This is how much Anu can lead and fully show in a workspace. Boy, did that change once I became a mother. Mm-hmm. Because suddenly I had maybe 1,800 hours worth of more things to do, but also the kind of capacity that I did not know that existed that just opened up because I started to care a lot more. It started to ache a lot more. It started to burn my very insides every single time I knew that there was a case and there is a rescue waiting to happen and we don't have enough resources to show up. And as a leader, I think, and I, unfortunately I don't have my colleagues to vouch for this, but I'm gonna speak for you, the men colleagues in my team. Their experience has been richer because I have been able to look at the man's role in the household too and invite them to a workspace that is inclusive. But I'm not thinking, okay, you have X, Y, and Z things to do, but you just turned a dad. I think you're going to take a month or two off in a way that you can acclimatize to being a dad. Because I don't want you not showing up to your spouse as a good, you know, husband and a father, and then being excellent at workplace, because that's not going to go well with my work ethic. And that is actually translated into a more wholesome organization, I would say. Well, I can speak for hours on how awesome it is to be led by me or be led by Allison. But that's for you to know and for me to find out in some conversation in the corridor. But Allison, you go.
You know what, Dave? I'm laughing because you may not know. This is a question I actually don't talk, or this is a conversation I actually don't talk about very often, and a question that if vetted, I might have said no thanks to. So I love that you asked it.
Because I was like, ask my husband that. Like, why are you asking me that? How do you manage?
No, it's exactly right. So my, so I am of, I guess I'm learning, maybe this is why I don't talk about it a lot, because I'm navigating it in real time and learning, right? And so I will invite you in on this journey. I'm of the privileged few, I now realize, that has benefited from a diverse group of men and women and leaders and mentors and teachers who have shaped me since I was a little girl into who I am. Young, old, men, women, black, white, brown, in formal settings and informal settings. And for reasons I realized at a young age, God had gifted me with the gift of leadership, and I could use it in positive ways or less positive ways. Thank goodness for the guardrails and mentors around me. And so I have been leading since I was a young girl, and I was leading in the marketplace first. I was actually the general manager and was opening different franchises, you know, before I went into the finance industry, and then God called me into ministry. So it wasn't a top of mind reality for me. When I started at Compassion and started doing a seminary education, my husband became the primary caregiver of our kids. Certainly in that season of life, we recognize there's not that many people that we can relate to or that he could relate to, but certainly never encountered, you know, setbacks that I would have felt or experienced. Now, once I stepped into first chair leadership in an evangelical organization, most definitely at that point, you then encounter and hear and experience different positions that people have on women in leadership in ways that sometimes are personal and other ways are not personal. And so I've been navigating that, you know, in the last few years. But to Anu's point, I do think it was actually the birth of my daughters that God used to call me into ministry, and the recognition that my kids had everything they could ever needed and more than they could ever want, while other kids around the world were just struggling to survive, never mind thrive. And I started being connected to the other mothers' hearts around the world. And so most definitely that maternal instinct and love for kids I brought into the organization and into my role. And I do think it shapes how I show up as a leader. And we have an amazing executive team of men and women, and we all value unity and diversity and really leaning into not just the different age and gender diversity and ethnic diversity that we bring, but diversity of thought and experience and expression that God uses to strengthen all of us. So I don't know if there was an answer in that, but I'm navigating it in real time.
I want to add to it, because, I mean, you did ask about challenges. When I was in the field, I'm probably going out of time, but that's okay. When I was in the field, I would walk into these big government offices with, you know, officials who are men, and I would take this case and say, hey, you know, we have this many people who are trapped, we need them to be rescued, and this guy would look at me and then look for another man in the room. Mm-hmm. And then he would find a man, and he would look to that man and have the conversation. It was so infuriating. And I would keep, and in the beginning, they were like, well, maybe we should just let him speak. I was like, no, I'm going to insist. So I think one of the last rescues that I had to lead, I went back to the same office, and I was like, me, sir, me, look at me and talk to me. I'm bringing the case to you. So it has been interesting because of how, you know, these things plays out in different parts of the world. But I think the response that I would have is continue to show up. And unapologetically being myself, and you know, I've been created this way, and I'm going to show up this way. Yeah. In my
glad you are.
Sorry, and the works and all. No apologies there. Thank you.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. This will be an easier question, I promise. we're gonna get to some Q&A, but before we do, I'd love just some like kind of popcorn answers. Mm. So obviously
that means short.
Short.
Get out of time. Get out of time. No pressure.
So you know, we know about sponsoring a child through Compassion. It's a great way for us to get involved. You can become a Freedom Partner with IJM, same kind of monthly thing. What are some other really practical things that we can be doing to continue to support the good work of justice and poverty alleviation around the world? Are there purchasing choices we can make? Are there ways we can engage? Are there ways we can use our social media? What can we do?
Yeah, Freedom Partner, less than $1 a day, you can do this every single month and ensure that people are being rescued. Purchasing toys, I know it sounds like a no-brainer, but it's not. The last time I did a check on how much slaves I'm engaging in my, you know, clothing decisions or my fashion decisions, though it's non-existent, 15,000 people. Like 15,000 people. You know, the earrings that I wear, the sari that I wear, or the shoes that I choose to wear. And I think it is important to figure out how it is that we can minimize the damage on that. Supply chain is never clean until Canada has recently passed a bill. So how about actively getting and advocating with your local politicians, your MPs, partner with organizations like IJM and Compassion, and find ways to use the social media to talk about why this is not okay. Nobody wants to be part of the problem. You want to be part of the solution. So yes, definitely figure out how is it that, and thrift stores are cool. Like you get a variety of clothes that, you know, somebody has owned for a long time, but they don't smell if you, you know, just give them a wash. It's a great way to ensure that you are not perpetuating the crime. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be another perpetrator. And again, social media, talking to your local politicians, finding out more about this problem and also being part of the solution. Hmm. I've run out of ideas.
No, I think that's it. Like I would categorize them, learn, pray, live, and give.
Oh, and
maybe.
Pray.
Yeah, and it's all right. I got you.
Thank you.
So like learning about the issues, right? Yeah. There's so many ways you can do that. You can go on either one of our websites, read our blogs, engage in films, engage in, we have like a book curriculum for adults and kids and young people. You know, living that compassionate consumption idea is really, really critically important, whether it's the clothes that you buy, the energy and the water that you use. These things do have ramifications for the world's most vulnerable. Praying, of course, right, is critically important to pray for the needs of our local and global neighbors. And there's amazing ways for any parents in the room that you can do that at your table, on the spot while you're driving, certainly the precious time at bed. And giving, I would acknowledge there's strategic giving, which starts with your local church. So please start there. I was so encouraged to hear the ethos of this church, and was it 15% of every dollar given goes to global missions, which is remarkable, but give to your local church, give to global organizations like IJM and Compassion who have skin in the game and have, you know, boots on the ground there. But also giving spontaneously, you know, as you see people in need, allow God to speak to your heart and mind and give in those moments. And sacrificially, this is something as a parent that I find really effective when it's birthdays or Christmas or times where kids are used to acquiring and receiving, how you can help them build a posture of generosity by sacrificing, receiving, forgiving instead.
Yeah, love that. Time for some Q&A. Does anyone out here have a question for either Allison or Anu? Got one here. There's a microphone. It's coming to you. Here we go.
Hi, I'm Crystal. You speak of vulnerable children and helping them, and I'm a mom of two children with special needs. Ah. And so that is something that speaks to my heart and reaching other moms that are also in that situation. And one thing that it brought to my eyes is that kids with special needs all over the world are sometimes being given up because they are different, because they look different. And then they end up in foster systems or orphanages, and they're left without medical care, medical devices, and all of those really important things that can help them thrive. So I'm just wondering if you have any feet on the ground that are helping in that way, because they are some of the most vulnerable kids in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe one of the things that I would say is that our work proactively addresses that as we encounter it in every community that we're in. And so in part, you didn't say this, but so much of what we encounter is otherizing in different ways, gender, ethnicity, ability, right? In ways that has life and death ramifications over time, right? And when it's fueled by different forms of propaganda or just resourced, it can have huge ramifications. So we address that at the source by really working with our local church partners to instill a mindset that says every life matters, that from the moment that they are in the womb, they matter to God, and helping moms choose to give birth to their babies, no matter the circumstance, helping them with afterbirth care, ensuring that when there is circumstances of disability or whatever it might be in the life of a child, that they are uniquely and disproportionately invested in, you know, in the family context with the tutors and psychologists in our program and in, you know, the context of the church as a whole. So it is woven through everything that we do in the countries that we work.
Yeah, and it's the same for IJM. You know, as we encounter these challenges, we work with amazing partners who are able to help walk us through solving this, because it is unique. There are women and children who are vulnerable, but people who are more vulnerable are those who have been differently abled. It just makes it a lot more complicated because they're not able to express about how they've been violated, what happens. Yeah.
Well, they can't speak for themselves.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
I'll give the mic to the beautiful lady up front here.
I have a question about how you support your teams on the ground. I'm thinking in terms of secondary trauma, some of those kind of pieces. How do you care for your teams?
Great question. Vicarious trauma is something that is like a given in the work like this. And it's just so helpful that we have a God that we are centered in. Every single time that, and this is a practice that teams after me, the leaders that I have trained continue to practice. After every single rescue, or let's even start from the rescue, the beginning of the rescue is us having to process what it is that these victims are encountering. You know, what kind of violence, why is there an urgency? We actually have to grade how soon we need to get in to extract them, you know, provided every other implications are resolved. And I think it starts impacting the teams from that point, from identifying the need to be there, investigating, getting more information, processing that information with a larger team, and then finding the right time to go in and extract them with the police and the public justice system. And then following up through the entire process of their rehabilitation, it is not easy. It is absolutely not easy, but we do it with prayer. Our debrief times, I mock, you know, the trench humor in the field is far more developed than any other humor that I've been able to, you know, kind of witness anywhere else. Because we are able to come sit in this room and debrief and talk about how we feel. We laugh, we mock, we cry, and we stay in silence. But we do address it. There is no walking away from that time of processing it together. And then we do that within the team, then we do that within the larger office, and from the office to the global team that prays for us continuously. We have thousands of church partners who come together along in this journey. The country that I was able to work in, we would activate these partners who would come together and pray for us every single time we are out on a rescue. So I can say that we are safely covered from that angle, but at the same time, it is an everyday journey that every leader needs to be mindful of, mm-hmm. and this is a priority for us. Mm-hmm. It's a non-negotiable, you know, whether it's the process of the rescue or the after, because some of these cases take years, you know, when the judgment is coming through. There is a journey that the survivor is on. There is also the journey that the aftercare worker is on. She's not able to fathom what is going to happen when the judgment is given for a particular case. So we work closely with every single individual, and the leaders are also taken care of by the larger organization. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Any more questions?
Got time for maybe one more.
One back here. Great.
Thanks. Allison Anu, can you please tell us, why do you need each other?
So awesome. How can I not have her in my life? Oh, no. Wait. You go first, Allison.
Why do we need each other? Oh, my goodness. It's such a simple and important question. Let's see if I can answer it in simple and vital ways. The problem of violence against kids living in extreme poverty is unrelenting. And to the degree that our mission exists to end poverty in the lives of kids and their family, which it does, we can't do that unless we're addressing violence against the poor. And who better to partner with to address violence against the poor than the world's largest anti-modern slavery and anti-human trafficking organization who shares our Jesus-centered kingdom values. So it is mission critical in the work that we do.
Yeah, thank you. That is perfectly well put. To add a layer to that, we were seeing, I mean, that is literally why IGM was founded. We were seeing that there were countries that were trying to respond to the problem of poverty by, say, giving free education, giving access to water, everything it is that society needs. But kids were getting raped on the way to school. Women were getting exploited on the way to, you know, drawing water from the well. You could be, and we've seen this play in the field itself. You know, you would have governments giving bursaries and grants and all sorts of benefits, but the perpetrator would come and take it all because he has stolen the identity when he has got all of these people enslaved under him. So he owns him, the slave, and everything that he owns. So it just makes sense to be able to tackle that problem. And again, it is perpetual, right? I mean, we can come in and, you know, address the violence. We can partner with the public justice system, repair the system. But how do we make sure that people are not going to stay in that place of poverty? Partners like Compassion come together and ensure that we have world-class care that is afforded, because the poor deserve the best. Those who are oppressed are also children of God. They deserve nothing short of the best. So this partnership makes sense, and we need each other.
Well, thank you. We are going to wrap the podcast part of this now. So if you've been listening along, or if you're here in the room, thank you. And we'll be back next week with more Postscript.